Hello, Mr. Postman. Did I get any mail today? No? Okay, thank you. I'll see you tomorrow then. Mr. Postman.
I received a letter from my sister who was 6 years old at the time. It was just like a picture of me and her together. We were playing. She just drew like flowers on there, made it look so cute. And it really made me miss home. And I felt sort of still connected to her. She even sent me like these little candies in the letter in case I, you know, wanted them. So it was just a very sweet moment to open up the letter and see the effort she put into it. To
pay. You're listening to Exit Spring Mountain, a podcast celebrating Asian American and Pacific Islander history and examining AAPI issues. I'm your host, Lorraine Blanco Moss. Thanks for listening and supporting our stories. In this episode, we're talking about the care packages we send and receive to offer help and hope to our families and friends abroad. Our Filipino listeners might be familiar with balik bayan boxes, corrugated boxes filled with American goodies. Las Vegas companies like XYZ Global Express, Forex, and Atlas Shippers are extra busy this time of year, shipping to and from the Philippine Islands. Many Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders also send remittances, funds transferred from migrants or recent immigrants to their home countries. What does this money pay for? Why do AAPI communities continue this practice? And how can this be a lifeline for families and governments in other countries? Everyone on our Exit Spring Mountain team has watched family members pack items and gather money to send back to their home countries. But we all wondered the same thing growing up. Why? My sisters and I saw my dad send all kinds of stuff back to the Philippines. But being so young and so disconnected from our relatives there, it was hard to understand the duty and obligation my father felt for his extended family. In fact, the Philippines is very reliant on remittances and the balik bayan economy. Constancio Arnaldo is an assistant professor in the Department of Interdisciplinary Gender and Ethnic Studies at UNLV. It's a program within Asian and Asian American Studies. He explains the history.
Filipino entrepreneurs actually were the ones who standardized the cardboard boxes with that balik bayan label placed on the boxes. Because before, Filipino Americans would just like find like baby diaper boxes or any kind of box that they could fit. But Filipino entrepreneurs were like, well, let's actually make a box that says balik bayan.
Rico Nunga is one of the entrepreneurs he's talking about. In 1985, he founded one of the first door-to-door balik bayan companies. Filipinos, like many other Asians and Asian Americans, also send remittances.
Either gets wired. I mean, back in the old days, it used to get sent by mail. But for the most part, it's a sum of money that gets sent to another country. It can be a gift or it can be in the form of a good. And there is a difference in terms of remittances and a balik bayan, right? So remittances go back to the early 20th century, when Filipinos, mainly men, would work. They'd leave the Philippines, they'd go to the U.S., and they would work. They were exploited laborers, they were cheap laborers, they were racialized. And so they would actually send money back to the Philippines. But in terms of the balik bayan program, it was actually implemented by Ferdinand Marcos, the president slash dictator of the Philippines in 1973. He would encourage Filipinos to come back as tourists to help like float the economy, boost the Philippine economy, because the Philippine economy was struggling. There was extrajudicial killings. He would kill people that opposed him. He would kill journalists.
Marcos also started the balik bayan program to incentivize Filipino Americans to give back to their home country. They were offered reduced airfares, hotel discounts, and tax breaks. Simultaneously, martial law was in place at the time.
Part of this Balakbayan program was to actually help create a better image for the Philippines, that it wasn't as bad as what maybe was being reported. In addition, he also implemented this labor exporting program where the Philippine state would export human labor to various parts of Asia, the Middle East, the US, to ease the national debt that the World Bank and the IMF kind of perpetuated. And so this legacy kind of informs how and why the Philippines continues to be one of the top countries to like outsource its labor. And even if we think about the Philippines now, it's still kind of under neo-colonial control, where the United States still exploits the Philippines through various economic political policies. And because of that, it exerts a powerful control of the Philippine nation state.
According to the Philippine Central Bank, in 2021, Filipinos sent a record $31.4 billion in cash remittances back to their home country. The International Fund for Agricultural Development says more than 80 countries rely on remittances for more than 3% of their gross domestic product. In the Philippines, that number is closer to 10%. The IFAD also says in 2021, $605 billion U.S. dollars flowed to LMICs, low and middle income countries, including the Philippines. And there was an 8.6% increase in remittances from the year before.
Since 2017, I started a program where every weekend on a Sunday, I have someone managing what's called an egg and pandesal, which is their buns, local buns, breakfast. And it's for about 2.5 dozen, you know, 25 to 30 kids in the neighborhood, all relatives, distant relatives. The reason for that is to provide hope.
That's my father, Bernard Blanco. Although now retired and living on a fixed income, he still sends money and goods back to the Philippines. Without that assistance, some family members would go without basic needs like electricity, communication technology, and food.
The principal use of the money is for food. That's the first priority. The second one would be for doctor visit medicines. Even though doctor visits are generally free at the clinics, the medicine does cost. They have to go out and buy. They have to pay for labs for paraphernalia. And then the third would be for schooling. So education would be the third most important thing. The people that I work with, I essentially adopted a family of four, and they are a distant relative. And I expect weekly expense logs to ensure that the money's spent well.
Sometimes he also receives requests for things he won't send funds for, like luxury items such as smartphones.
In the very beginning, I did get a little touchy about that. But over time, I realized the psychology involved. As a general statement, I discovered that when you are in need, when you are in dire need, you are usually not embarrassed to ask for anything. So at worst, you'll get a no. And that's my job, to say no. And the reason I would sometimes say no, even if I could afford certain things, is because I want to lower the expectations. I want to give them hope, but at the same time, I don't want to provide unrealistic expectations. Because if, for example, I was to decide to buy a smartphone for one person, I guarantee you in the next day, there will be a dozen other people asking for the same thing. And then it becomes completely unmanageable. So I have to think in terms of sustainability.
And at times, there's also concern from family members here in the U.S. that maybe people are taking advantage of his generosity.
Every now and then, yes. My own family, brothers, sisters, etc., will say, you're going to be fooled. Don't be a sucker. They're always afraid to be cheated or that I would be cheated. But, you know, I have to make those decisions. I'd rather be cheated once out of 10 times than just to refuse to help.
My dad says the reaction from the children is worth the money, the time, and the potential pushback from those who might say he's spending too much.
The younger folks are just full of glee. One of my most exciting things is to receive half a dozen photos every Saturday here, which is Sunday over there, with the kids smiling and eating their bread or their eggs or their noodles. And there's always this thankfulness, which is completely gratifying to me. That's all I care about, seeing that smile. And every now and then I'll get a message saying, oh, you didn't forget us. I said, no, of course I didn't forget you. And that's all I care about.
You're listening to Exit Spring Mountain, an AAPI podcast from Nevada Public Radio. Coming up, we talk with the first-generation UNLV student about how rice crackers and cans of tuna keep him connected to his Chamorro family. You're listening to Exit Spring Mountain, a podcast that celebrates the history and examines issues in the AAPI community. We're talking about remittances, monetary transactions or care packages sent by Asian and AAPI migrants and immigrants back to their countries of origin.
Care packages, I mean, since I was a little kid, I've had family living out here in the States. So I'm kind of familiar with the care packages. I've been receiving them since I was young. I've helped my mom pack them, send them to family members out here in the States.
That's J.D. Regis. He is Chamorro from Saipan, the largest island in the Northern Mariana Islands, about 120 miles north of Guam. He sends American treats to the islands and receives goodies he grew up enjoying in return, like senbei rice crackers.
We expect to receive the things that you can't get out here, like mandarin haisi, the senbei, so much, like even tuna. Like, imagine, I'm always excited to receive Ace of Diamonds tuna, as a specific kind of tuna from back home. It's sort of a way to keep that connection with your family, with your friends. I mean, nowadays we have video call, voice call, but you can't physically be there or give them anything. So care packages are one of the only ways that you can physically give something to someone.
JD is the president of the Asian American Pacific Islander Student Association at UNLV. He's also the first in his family to attend college in the States.
It's very easy to fall out of touch back home. It's very easy. So I feel like all of these things are different ways for you to stay connected to your friends and family back home. So for me, I don't feel like a pressuring obligation. It feels more like an empowerment because, you know, I am able to send these gifts back home.
Whether Asian and Pacific Islander migrants and immigrants stay here for school or work temporarily, or they're making the U.S. home permanently, many find that remittances bridge the gap of physical and emotional distance.
Those objects then become a symbol of, let's say, success by the first generation. It's very transnational. And so, like, because Filipino Americans have this relationship with their family members or friends back home in the Philippines, they can continue to have these familial connections. It's not just an exchange process, but it's rather like a communal process where they maintain community ties with one another, even if they're thousands and thousands of miles away. And so the person that's away, the balik bayan, maybe it'll help them atone for being away.
According to the United Nations and the World Bank, family remittances help 1 out of 7 people worldwide. 75% of these funds pay for immediate household needs, and about half go to family in rural areas, where most of the world's poor and food insecure live. How long will this continue to go on for you?
As long as I'm alive.
No hesitation.
Yeah, even though I'm in retirement, no hesitation. Because quite frankly, one of the things I learned in the last few years, every time I'm having a meal like, let's say, sushi, and the bill comes up to $50 for two people, I'm thinking, wow, $50, what can that buy me in the Philippines? Unfortunately, that's the new psychology. Sometimes when I'm eating something special, like a big old ice cream and some special lobster or crabs or something, I stop for a moment and think, gee, you know, this meal, I could have used that to feed 10 people, 10 kids. Unfortunately, that's not a good way to live, but it's a necessary way to appreciate there are others that are less fortunate. It actually gives me some comfort. So I do it for myself. It's a question of worth. You know, what is one's self-worth?
You've been listening to Exit Spring Mountain, an AAPI podcast from Nevada Public Radio. We record this show on the lands of the Southern Paiute people. Thanks to our guest this episode, Constancio Arnaldo Jr., Bernardo Blanco, and J.D. Regis. This podcast was made possible with a grant from the Panda Community Fund. Music in this episode is courtesy of Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. Our team includes senior producer Nessa Concepcion,
Maligayang Pasko,
academic research consultant Mark Padungpat,
Suksan Wanyut,
and assistant producer and social media manager Isabel Chen Rice.
Sundan Jie Kuai Le.
Joe Shaneman oversees podcasts as news director at Nevada Public Radio.
And a sincere happy holidays to our listeners.
And our sound editing, mixing, and mastering is by Christopher Alvarez.
Feliz Navidad.
I'm your host, Lorraine Blanco Moss. Like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And leave us a review. Also, follow us on our new Instagram at Exit Spring Mountain. Thanks for listening. Your support keeps us going. Happy holidays. Feliz Natal.